The story goes that the church sacristan overheard Thomas Aquinas speaking in prayer before the crucifix. Thomas was asking whether all he had written about the Christian faith was correct. "You have spoken well of me, Thomas," came the audible answer. "What is your reward to be?" Thomas replied, "Non nisi te, Domini." "Nothing but you, Lord." From Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the college podcast, The After Dinner Scholar. On January 28th, we celebrate the feast day of St. Thomas Aquinas, and while most Catholics know that he has a special place in the Church, we may not appreciate how great a place he occupies. Dr. Michael Bolin has been studying Thomas Aquinas at least as far back as his undergraduate days at Thomas Aquinas College in California. I asked Dr. Bolin to give us a kind of crash course in the life and teaching of the angelic doctor.
All right, so Thomas Aquinas was born around the year 1225 in Aquino, Italy, which is about 80 miles southeast of Rome, so central Italy. He came from a family of minor nobility. His uncle was the abbot of the monastery, Benedictine monastery, Monte Cassino, and his family wanted him to follow in those footsteps. He was the youngest of the four sons, I believe, and it was so traditional that he would therefore enter religious life. He was sent to study philosophy and the liberal arts in Naples as a teenager. And at the end of that time, when he was around 19, he decided he did not want to be a Benedictine. He wanted to join the Dominicans, which were a very new religious order, only 20 or 30 years old, I believe. His family was not happy with that. They wanted him to go the more political aspect of the religious life in line with being nobility. And so story has it, two of his brothers kidnapped him and held him a prisoner in the family castle to try to get him to change his mind. And I guess the most famous part of that story is that they hired a woman to try to seduce him, and he famously chased her out with a hot poker or a burning log or some such, and is said to have been visited by two angels thereafter who gave him a girdle of chastity, or to symbolize the grace of perfect chastity, which I believe is where he gets the name the angelic doctor. You have no concupiscence, you're like an angel. So that's a famous story. Eventually, his family gave up on their project because he was pretty determined, and he went to study in Paris as a Dominican, which is probably where he met his teacher, St. Albert the Great, whom he followed to the University of Cologne for further studies. Another famous story there is that as a student of Albert the Great, Aquinas was famously quiet, and together with his large physical stature, that earned him the nickname the Dumb Ox among his fellow students. And St. Albert is reported to have said, "You call him the dumb ox, but one day his bellowing will fill the world." So that's another famous story. Around 1250, 1252, he was studying for his master's degree in theology, during which period he wrote his famous commentary in the Sentences of Peter Lombard, which is just what you did when you were studying for a master's degree in theology at that time. And then he was appointed a master of theology at the university in Paris. Over the next years, he traveled around some. He taught at Paris, at Orvieto, at Rome. Rome is where he taught in the mid-60s, where he began his most famous work, the Summa Theologiae. During that time, he also wrote the famous Eucharistic hymn, Pange Lingua. The last part of that, the Tantum Ergo, of course, is very well known. And he wrote that at the request of Pope Urban IV, I believe, who had just instituted the Feast of Corpus Christi, and so asked Aquinas to write a hymn for it. He taught theology and philosophy for much of his life. Towards the very end, around 1273, he's said to have had a kind of more and more mystical experiences, I guess, and had a vision wherein we don't know what exactly he saw, but he told his companion, secretary Reginald, that he couldn't write anymore because compared to what he had seen, all his writing was a straw, which is a pretty interesting tale. The final year, 1274, of his life, the Pope summoned him to attend the Second Council of Lyon, which I think was primarily directed at thinking about reuniting the Eastern and Western churches, which of course had split a couple centuries before in 1054. But he fell ill along the way and ended up dying at the Cistercian Monastery, Fossa Nova, I believe, on March 7th, which was his feast day originally. In 1274. He was canonized 50 years later, 1323, I believe, so not long after his death, and declared a doctor of the church a couple centuries later. A couple interesting stories there. They say that at the Council of Trent, during the deliberations, the council fathers would place on the altar the Bible, the decrees of the pontiffs, and the Summa Theologiae of Thomas Aquinas, which is quite an honor, right? And another, along the same lines, it said that during his canonization process, when we still had the devil's advocate, right, the person who argued why he shouldn't be canonized, the devil's advocate said there were no miracles attributed to the intercession of Aquinas, and therefore he couldn't be canonized. And one of the cardinals on the other side is said to have responded, there are as many miracles as there are articles in the Summa.
So. Well, Thomas was known to be a student of Aristotle. Aristotle was new to the medieval world at that point, rediscovered, and approached theology through an Aristotelian lens. How was that a break from the past, and how was that consistent with the past?
There were a number of thinkers at the time, and much earlier, who thought that there was an inherent tension between faith, revelation, and reason on the other hand. And so they didn't think that the use of pagan philosophers could be good, could only be bad for faith, for revelation. So in the second, even as early as the second century, for example, Tertullian is famously made the remark, what has Athens to do with Jerusalem? Where the idea is, what do we, the descendants, so to speak, of Jerusalem, the recipients of revelation, have to do with pagan philosophy? And so Tertullian said, the Greeks are the forefathers of heresy, not of the faith.
Doesn't St. Paul say something about deceptive philosophies? Or
right, there are a number of things one could draw on to make that case, right? Yeah. But that was certainly a school of thought, and it was still around in the Middle Ages. And so
it was quite today
as well. So it was quite radical of him to say, no, whatever truth cannot contradict truth, what truth that can be attained by reason must be compatible with truth that can be attained by revelation. It was radical in that way, merely in the sense that the Greek philosophy predated Christianity, of course. It created a kind of more continuity with the past in a certain sense.
Well, and then Pope Benedict has argued that it was God's providential will that Greek philosophy become part of the mix of Christianity.
Right, and that would fit with the way Thomas treated it. And there were others. I wouldn't say he's unique in that way. It's like St. Augustine, I think, would have been much more open to the idea of incorporating pagan philosophy. He seemed clear that whatever is true is the implicit patrimony of Christianity. So,
now, beyond bringing Aristotle into the conversation, what other theological and philosophical ideas were Thomas's most influential ones?
That's a big question. Well, there are a couple things that spring to mind. In ethics, he seems to be the originator of what today we call the doctrine or principle of double effect, which has to do with moral reasoning about situations in which your actions are going to cause something bad as well as something good. And when can you do that? When can you not do it? Under what conditions? So he's sort of the originator of that doctrine. He applies it to self-defense famously, where he says, lethal self-defense is only permitted if you don't intend the death of the aggressor, but you only intend to protect yourself or something. So it sort of originates there. Another big philosophical idea that he's known for is what's called the real distinction, or the distinction between essence and existence. So he sort of famously says that in God alone, essence and existence are the same. The what he is of God is the same as the that he is, and that's not true for any other creature. There are roots of that idea in Aristotle, I believe, but in terms of the clarity with which he expresses it, it seems to, he's kind of a father of that idea, and it has a lot of significance later on in philosophy.
Now, I also hear Thomas associated with something called virtue ethics.
There, too, he's following Aristotle, who's sort of the pagan originator of that idea.
What does that mean?
So the idea is something along the lines of, the point of ethics is to develop virtue, and would that mean something like make yourself into a certain kind of person? Well, let me explain that by contrasting with, there's the idea of consequentialism. That's a moral theory that says whether actions are good or bad depends entirely on the outcomes. Like whether or not I can kill this guy depends on whether it'll have good effects, right? And Aristotle
sacrificed the one child to save the city.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. The consequentialist might say that's okay. And virtue ethics, as found in Aristotle and developed by Aquinas, it's not only a question of that outcome, you also have to ask what it does to you. In other words, if you sacrifice the child, that makes you like the kind of person who kills innocent children. And that's a bad thing to do. In other words, because of the habit that it builds in you. And so one has to ask, what are the consequences? But one can't only ask that. You also have to ask, what are the consequences for me? What kind of a person does this make me into? And that's sort of the root of it. But,
that's almost a jumping off point. Why is Thomas still important today? Why do we study him here? Is he still important for the church generally?
Oh, goodness. Well, if one is interested in understanding, then I would say definitely yes. We've already touched a little bit on some of the reasons for that, right? That is, if you want faith to be integrated with reason, you're not going to be able to avoid philosophizing about theological issues and matters of faith. And he's sort of the model of that. John Paul II, in his encyclical Fides Oratio, sets him up as, I guess he says he's the model, the highest synthesis of faith and reason is found in Aquinas. And Leo XIII before him, in the encyclical Eterni Patri, said something similar. He said he needs to be the model for, say, seminary formation, because you don't just want to believe matters of faith, you want to understand them as much as possible. Aquinas is sort of, he's been held up by the church as the model for how to do that.
And we probably continue to need to hold him up as the model.
Well, I think so.
Pope St. John Paul II wrote, quote, "St. Thomas is an authentic model for all who seek the truth. In his thinking, the demands of reason and the power of faith found the most elevated synthesis ever attained by human thought. For he could defend the radical newness introduced by revelation without ever demeaning the venture proper to reason." Close quote. If you're interested in exploring St. Thomas's thinking, you might begin where our Wyoming Catholic College students begin, with Thomas's Compendium Theologiae, a work he wrote not so much for scholars, but for the rest of us. You could start on this feast of St. Thomas Aquinas and reading a bit each day, finish up at the same feast in 2023. It would be a wonderful accomplishment, and I think one that you'll be very glad you did. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.